Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, one of those ingenious electric thermometers poked into the ear of early October 2019. And this week we'll be in Cork, where the Spare Room Project has found a home in a previously loved bank, and in Dublin to mark the first decade of Kaleidoscope, where we'll be wondering 10 years on if pioneering ideas like a classical music club night could find a home in the city of 2019. Later on, we'll be taking the number 2 blade to director Wayne Jordan's show for younger audiences, The Haircut. But first, we're setting the controls for the heart of Manhattan at the end of the 1960s. Warhol's women. You might just get away with calling Velvet Underground collaborator Nico one of them, but it's hardly a grouping into which Valerie Solanas, the woman who shot Andy with a gun, would slip cheerfully. Yet in the new speculative history play Femme Fatale, set in a hotel room where the two women wait to appear in an underground movie, it's Warhol that brings these women together. All the better to examine the patriarchy, 60s downtown scene edition, according to the author of the piece, Polly Wiseman. Wiseman, who also plays Nico in the darkly comic two-hander alongside Sophie Olivia as Solanas, talked to Culturefile about the many ways for women artists to draw the short straw.
Hello, Berlin. You know, every time I return to this city, I remember why I left. I liked it best when it was burning. Total destruction is the most beautiful thing I have ever seen.
I first came across Nico's music probably at drama school when I had Velvet Underground and Nico. I guess I thought she was cool. Then I did a Warhol show years ago, actually, where I was playing another Warhol woman who was hanging around the factory.
Not Edie, who is mentioned in...
Yeah. I played Edie Sedgwick, and I did briefly play Nico in that show as well. It was a show where we took on different characters. So I suppose I had sort of known about her for years. In terms of feminism, she's an interesting one because she would never have called herself a feminist, and she was quite scathing about women a lot of the time. But actually, in being a pioneer in her field, she was certainly a pioneer in music and in negotiating the male-dominated world of rock. I would say she was part of the gains feminism made, despite the fact that she would never have called herself a feminist. She wished she'd been born a man, was the so that's not very feminist. By that, she probably meant her life would have been easier. She would have been able to do the things she wanted more easily than she actually could. She didn't really have a home as such. She never actually owned property. Oh, she did. She bought a house on Ibiza, but her mother lived there. So she really was quite a nomad. She was a sort of a proper bohemian in that she just really had a shoulder bag of clothes and a harmonium, and that was it. She travelled around. I think she stayed on people's sofas a lot until people like Paul McCartney, until they had to sort of basically kick her out. One of the tragedies of her life is she was seen as a kind of high-class groupie, which isn't really fair. I mean, she had relationships with Brian Jones and with Jim Morrison, obviously, and some other people. But sort of, I think that's in that society, that's how people tended to define her.
You say Jim Morrison, obviously, everybody had a relationship with Jim Morrison.
It's a bit like that. I think that was the problem. She called him her soul brother, but I think that the reality was that obviously he was quite happily not being very soul brotherly and seeing quite a lot of other women at the same time.
You know, a bomb blast takes time to be felt. First comes the flesh, then the shock waves, and only then do the buildings fall.
We're in a hotel room in New York City in somewhere in the late 60s, and Nico is waiting there for Jim Morrison, but she's not waiting alone.
She and Valerie Solanas are both waiting to film Warhol's movie I Am Man, which they were both in. So there is a legitimate reason why Valerie is, so she can't actually kick her out.
Although you did pretty much, you imagined that must have happened.
I know they will have hung out in the same space at some point in that period.
So who was Valerie Solanas?
Valerie Solanas was, I suppose, an influential second wave feminist now, looking back. She came from a sort of dirt poor background. She had two children by the time she was 15, both of which she gave up for adoption. She was also an out lesbian in the late 50s, which was didn't make her any friends. And when she graduated as a psychologist, nobody would employ her because she was female and it was the early 60s in America. So this made her understandably quite bitter towards the patriarchy and the system of men getting all the best gigs. So Valerie eventually she wrote something called The Scum Manifesto, which was her Society for Cutting Up Men, which posited the solution to the world's problems was to kill all the men. And she wrote a play called Up Your Ass, which she wanted Andy Warhol to produce. And she gave him her script and he just basically didn't get back to her about it. And she came to believe that he'd stolen it and used some of the lines for his films.
And from what we know of Warhol, that's not an improbable notion.
From what we know of Warhol, Valerie Solanas wasn't the only person that he stole. Potentially, allegedly, I think I have to say allegedly, stole...
He's well dead.
Yeah, you can't slander the dead, that's true. So Andy Warhol potentially borrowed, shall we say, the work of not just Valerie Solanas, but there was a Japanese artist that we were discussing, Yoi Kusama, who potentially had the first idea for the repeated Marilyn Monroe pictures, which Warhol subsequently made a big success with. So the idea that Warhol would steal from the work of women seems fairly true.
Now that it's time, now that the hour hand is landed at the end, now that it's real.
Those two women, I suppose, are quite useful as ways of exploring society in that they were so different. Valerie absolutely rejected all the conventional tropes of being a woman and gave up her kids for adoption, didn't wear makeup, dressed like a man, was very overt and in demanding what she wanted. Whereas Nico sort of exemplified the 60s blonde Dolly Bird who all the men liked and wanted to sleep with. It could appear that she was this sort of uber groupie who'd slept away to the top, which is unfair. You could say that she was following the very conventional route for a woman in the eyes of that society. So it was interesting to see what happens if a woman embraces all those rules but is miserable about it. And what happens if a woman rejects all those rules but can't get her foot in the door, can't get her work noticed. So what are the boundaries of that society and what can we do to change them?
And it is finally I decide that I be leaving in the fairest of the seasons.
I found it interesting writing the show and trying to think about if Valerie and Nico were working alive and working today, whether they'd have an easier time of it. And I think in some ways they would. The internet, for instance, would mean that Valerie could get her message out without needing an intermediary. But I think she'd be horribly trolled by many people online. And Nico, I think, would... Superficially, people would still be saying, you looked better when you were this blonde bombshell. Why have you dyed your hair black and why are you singing these moody goth songs and looking a bit like you've gone to seed?
In the tour that's going to happen, you're also trying to kind of rewrite the Scum Manifesto or enlarge at least.
Yes, we're really hoping to create a feminist manifesto for now, and we'd love our audiences and people beyond our audience to contribute.
And if there's no change, what do you think about the idea of getting a gun?
I have thought about, if I had a gun, who would I take out first? And I suppose writing a play about a woman who did just that, it does make you think, well, would I? Could I do that? Would it be worth it? Oh, dear. That makes me sound very...
Well, luckily enough, Warhol's gone, so you don't have to do him.
Yes, I suppose someone already took care of Andy Warhol, but there's a few of them out there, aren't there?
Polly Wiseman there on her new play Femme Fatale, which runs at the Omnibus Theatre in London from October 8th. And next on the Culture File Weekly, the decline of the High Street Bank. It's been something of a boon for activist art. We heard previously on Culture File about Bank Job, a critical art project based inside an abandoned High Street Bank in Walthamstow in North London. Currently in Cork, an arts group has set up in a disused bank, all the better to critique the economic flows that have produced a plague of empty banks and a world of rolling dispossession. The project spare room, subtitled Art, Architecture, Activism, has come to rest in the former permanent TSB building on Cork's North Main Street, reconfiguring things to showcase the work of artists and architects whose practice engages with design, architecture, activism and space. Culture Files' Rachel Andrews took some shelter there and met some of those behind the project.
So now we're in the centre of the old permanent TSB bank, which is now the middle space of the exhibition. We had five main spaces. The idea with middle space was it would be the social space of the project, that it would be the space that would tie everything together. This encompasses a lot of things. What you're looking at now in front of you is reconfigurable furniture designed by Aideen O'Donovan. So if you see the flooring turns into the seats, turns into the tables, it's like basically a giant jigsaw.
My name is Eve Olney and I'm co-producer of the exhibition Spare Room that we're in at the moment. And Spare Room is the second iteration of the collaborative scheme called Art, Architecture, Activism. The idea behind Art, Architecture, Activism is basically to use collective practices and skill sharing and a sort of acceptance of all types of knowledge or knowing or experiences in life to create a very approachable, I suppose, aesthetic or representation or platform for social projects around housing and I suppose, precarious living.
The highway is alive tonight. Nobody's kidding, nobody about
the idea of Art, Architecture, Activism then became that it would visit different cities for each iteration. It would inhabit, not occupy. Again, it's the language within it is really important. So it would inhabit an empty prominent building in a city centre and then engage with already existing social projects. But I suppose the main objective, which I think is incredibly important to emphasise, is that we work with long-term sustainable projects. So it's not kind of going into a city, engaging with people and then leaving.
Got a one-way ticket to the promised land.
So yeah, now we're in the space of the Living Commons, and as you can see, it's quite an empty space, and you know, that's deliberate in that the idea is because we have a full programme of workshops that the space sort of builds up with each workshop. We leave whatever's produced here because all the workshops are around commoning practices, again, community building. This, what you see at the moment, are the remnants of a great workshop we had, How to Build a Playground.
I'm looking at a photograph of the former permanent TSB, but it has the words, the Living Commons, on the sign.
And then as you can see, it's been photoshopped. So the idea of this poster came from, you know, the kind of posters that you see outside construction sites that developers put up. And they're, you know, I mean, they're propaganda as to showing us the ideal life. And it's usually lovely boardwalks and people having lattes and, you know, fair enough, with lovely blue skies. So the idea was to really kind of mimic that and make it look like, and also, though, on a serious note, that, you know, to emphasize the point that the commons can be set up anywhere, you know, rural, urban or whatever. And to prove that, because the idea of the commons is as well, we're not doing anything original, right? It will be the first commons in Ireland, but at the same time, everything we're incorporating into the, or unfolding into the commons already exists in Ireland in pockets.
If we just define commoning for people.
It's where the individual is allowed to have autonomy, privacy, but is also working in or in keeping, that is in keeping or achieved with the autonomy of the community. So it's about self-governance, it's about self-organisation. It's about people really having a voice and a role in how their lives are structured.
My name is Kate O'Shea. My background is a mix of, I guess, producing social spaces, printmaking and publishing. So I'm an architecture dropout. So when I dropped out of architecture college, when I was 19, I set up a cafe and social space in Kerry. I ran this for 7 years with a friend. So that's kind of, I guess that's the core of where everything comes from. That would be where, I guess, the seeds for the People's Kitchen started. The idea of having, building towards having a permanent social space again, and how you need physical spaces for people to make and imagine different ways of living. The People's Kitchen started with, the idea was giving food out at cost price and collective food making. So we'd get quite big groups of people together to make food together and then do a community event with performance and music.
So we have the doors open and a sign outside to come in and have something to eat. So the idea is also that you can come in, and if you've no money, you just get this amazing, really healthy meal. And if you do have money, you put something in the pot, sort of thing.
I think for us, the big thing was definitely not wanting it to stay within the arts community. And, you know, these are ideas for everybody, and how do you reach everybody? And we've just found by having open doors in a city centre building, everybody that passes comes in.
Every project here will be continued and recited in a new space that we're kind of negotiating at the moment with people on. So as a permanent sort of commoning space, we want to create a space where these organisations can come together and collaborate, hopefully. And then build kind of a bigger movement. So again, the whole thing is about kind of gaining, you know, finding that kind of, of course, there's conflict and difference and politics, but we're trying to kind of put that aside and kind of work together for a common goal. And that would be kind of choosing people-led values over economic. Last shall be first and the first shall be last.
Rachel Andrews there, reporting from Spare Room in Cork. And there's more information about a range of art, architecture and activism projects at spareroomproject.ie. Now, this week marked a decade of concerts from Kaleidoscope, a club night showcasing classical and contemporary sounds in informal, clubby settings. But with closures of venues small and large in Dublin city centre, what does the future hold for an event like Kaleidoscope? If indeed there is anything quite like Kaleidoscope, which this time around features minimalist masterpiece Shaker Loops by John Adams, as well as the Baroque group Gregory Walker's with a traditional Irish dancer, and the Chatham Saxophone Quartet with a baron player. Ornya Gallagher met current curators Lioba Petrie and Karen Durvin alongside their sound engineer Adrian Hart to talk music, loops and venues in Dublin today.
It's the nature of a venue that people associate with a different type of music and that element of surprise. And occasionally in our home of the Bellow Bar, we do have people who wander down the stairs because they've seen the poster outside, and they're completely blown away by the idea of what we're doing.
My name is Karen Durbin. I'm a co-curator of Kaleidoscope, and I'm a viola player.
While wanting to still give people a listening experience like they would have in a typical classical music venue, be that a church or a concert hall, we want them to have a different kind of experience as people. Let them be closer to the performers, let them chat to the performers during the performance. No, it doesn't always happen during the performance, but let them chat to them at the interval, break down that barrier. With the right venue, that's very easily done.
When artists and musicians are at Kaleidoscope and they meet for the first time, and then maybe they might come back to us a couple of months later and say, oh, I have this project, I met that person at Kaleidoscope, and can we present this? Or, you know, it's amazing for myself and Karen, for musicians to come to us saying, I have this little project, I need a platform, can I have a slot? And that's so exciting.
That's loads of them, yeah. And then we just do a little bit of the harmonic-y kind of stuff from...
There's been a bit of huffing and puffing in the last few years about the National Concert Hall and how now there are non-classical things happening there with great regularity, which is a brilliant thing. But it's funny how people are saying, oh, isn't it amazing now that it's not just classical music that's in the concert hall? And yes, it is, but actually we really need the concert hall. You cannot perform orchestral music anywhere in Dublin except the National Concert Hall, the RDS, the Helix maybe, and churches. So, you know, here's us then as Kaleidoscope, we're getting into their, you can't see inverted commas on radio, but we're getting into their territory a little bit. The exclusivity that people think exists around classical music, I've never felt that, but I would hate to think that anyone would think they don't belong in the National Concert Hall, because they belong in the National Concert Hall as much as the Bellow Bar or any other venue where classical music is presented.
So my name's Leoba Petrie and I'm the co-curator of Kaleidoscope, and I'm a cellist. Yeah, this concert, we went for pieces that we really love, that we've had, that have featured in our series. So Shake Loops would have been a very popular one, has influenced a lot of composers that would have had their pieces performed at Kaleidoscope as well, contemporary composers. Also, Ian Wilson's Heaven Lay Close was a real highlight for the two of us, actually. That's the Chatham Saxophone Quartet with a baron, Amy Farrell Courtney, on baron. And that's a really special piece. It's just such fun, such a great mix. Originally written for string quartet and tabla, and then was rearranged for the Chatham Saxophone Quartet and with baron.
I am Adrian Hart, and yeah, I've been sound engineer for Kaleidoscope for 10 years. I'm also a musician and a producer.
Going back to the venues, I mean, everyone's talking about all these smaller venues being closed down. What's your opinion on what's going to happen with the musical scene if these kind of venues continue to close?
I mean, it could do, maybe, because I as a player, because I play in some very informal environments, particularly in, you know, in the States or in Europe. And I mean, Ireland's celebrated for its informal or spontaneous music or social aspect of music. Dublin's famed for its live music, and Kaleidoscope, I guess, has tried to straddle, got everything between the concert hall and the bar. Detroit, famously in the States, apparently it's the new Berlin because it's a quarter of the population it used to be. It has all these social performance spaces because just had all these buildings. Now we have the opposite problem in that we have fewer spaces. I mean, I live down the road from Thomas Street and it's all hotels. Like, I guess everything, although Dublin has this live music reputation, everything's hotels right now. And actually, I mean, I know a little bit about venues, but even studio spaces, I know of about 4 or 5 small studios in town, maybe more, that have kind of gone, and it's either a mall or a hotel, you know, in preparation for whatever. You know, there's a lot of things happening that I think it's kind of preparing for.
If it means that things are happening in suburban areas of Dublin, that's fine too. These venues will always exist, we hope, in suburbia. But the city centre right now, you know, it looks pretty bleak for culture. I'm just going to say it.
Áine Gallagher there, reporting from the property development versus culture frontline. And finally on this week's Weekly, we're off to the not-yet-threatened-with-closure ARC Cultural Centre for Kids. Larry Lynchuk has one big secret, and anyone familiar with this popular snip of folklore may not gasp at the big reveal. But there are still surprises in The Haircut, writer Wayne Jordan and composer Tom Lane's new musical retelling of the myth for younger audiences. Culturefile's Áine Gallagher went to meet Jordan and Lane to talk about their tale of the nasty ruler with a thing about his hair.
My name's Wayne Jordan. I am the writer and director of The Haircut, a version of the old Irish story about Larry Lynchuk, who is the king who has long hair and he only has it cut once a year. And afterwards, he always has the barbers killed because he has a secret.
And he insisted that everything turn inwards and nothing ever change.
To be honest, actually, I'm not so interested in making theatre for young people that is about them learning. It's, I guess, about them kind of, like all art, it's for them to kind of reflect and enjoy and make their own decisions about what. So it's not necessarily educational, but of course the story itself has a moral and a maxim and stuff. And our piece focuses on ideas about like secrets and the problems of keeping secrets and what it means to live under a difficult person in power.
The kingdom was the happy place. It was busy and loud in places like a headache.
The piece is kind of a story told in a concert form, and there's one actor, Thomas Cain Byrne, and then three musicians, a clarinetist, a cellist, and a percussionist. So it works as a kind of remix of the original story with a live soundtrack, which is composed by Tom Lane.
The king's name was Linshach, Lowrie Linshach, and Lowrie Linshach was the High King of Ireland.
My name's Tom Lane, and I'm the composer and musical director for The Haggut. It's a very kind of broad range of styles and types of music. Some of it's quite sort of contemporary sounding, as in kind of contemporary music, contemporary classical music. So it's quite dissonant and edgy, and that reflects certain parts of the story.
Strange looking long for a man of his nature, especially since it didn't suit him, as it hadn't suited any of the long-haired Linshachs, whose grey pictures hung on the dark halls of the castle.
But then some of it's much more melodic, and that kind of fits with the storytelling aspect, and it's evoking a certain type of mood and atmosphere of the piece. The score is for clarinet, cello and percussion, and the percussionist plays a whole different variety of instruments, including marimba and vibraphone and things like snare drum, bass drum, and there's some big gongs as well. And we also have other instruments for everyone to play, like little harps, and there's also some singing in the piece, so lots of different types of sounds.
Also, there's some other kind of like sound making elements in the show. So we do a little bit of kind of Foley art and some kind of objects that make sounds, and the music, like the haircut itself. Tom has scored a kind of haircut with hair dryers and scissors and percussion. I knew it as an Irish story about Lowrie Linshach, but it's a story that appears in similar versions in many, many countries like China, the Balkans, Wales, like all over the place. And the parts of the story that happen a lot are that there's a king, and that king has his haircut once a year, and he kills the barbers. And the reason he kills the barbers is because he's hiding the fact that he has donkey's ears that hidden underneath his haircut. And in lots of ways, it's about him coming to terms. Well, the end of the play can be in some ways about him coming to terms with being different.
Always the same haircut and always the same story.
Áine Gallagher was talking there to Wayne Jordan and Tom Lane about their new Eights and Up musical, The Haircut, which opens October 10th at the Ark in Dublin. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more tendentious quaffs next Friday at 7. Until then, bye now.